Can you give me the basics?
Well, this book isn't arranged that way. What do you want to know?
Well, why did you disappear when you stepped off the porch? Are we halfway to heaven? Are we halfway to hell? And how long is this going to last?
I don't see anything about heaven or hell. This book reads like stereo instructions. Listen to this. Geographical and temporal perimeters. Functional perimeters vary from manifestation to manifestation. Oh, this is going to take some time, honey.
Welcome to this special Halloween-themed Beetlejuice retrospective series.
It's perfect. Just perfect.
Join Garrett.
I'm the ghost with the most, babe.
Matt.
Barbara, we did call him and he seemed awfully pissed off.
And Adam.
Live people ignore the strange and unusual. I myself am strange and unusual.
As they look at Tim Burton's 1988 film Beetlejuice, as well as its sequel, Beetlejuice Beetlejuice, released earlier this year.
The juice is loose.
Will Garrett's love of Winona Ryder influence his feelings on these films?
If I could just get away from her permanently.
You want me to marry?
But you never ask.
After tearing Burton a new one on his Planet of the Apes remake earlier this year, will the boys find it in their hearts to like one of his very first films?
I didn't want to bring it up. But rather than have you stumble onto it and make another mistake, I'll tell you.
And will known later Burton career hater Matt ever like a Burton film reviewed on this podcast?
So few clients are able to read my mind. They're just not open to the experience.
These answers and more coming up courtesy of Percolated Media.
It's showtime.
Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, a.k.a. Beetlejuice 2, a.k.a. Beetlejuice 2 Electric Boogaloo, released September 6th, 2024. Budget was about $100 million, as of this recording, with a box office take of $272 million. And this was directed by who else but Tim Burton? Boys, we talked about this on the last show. 36 years is a long time to wait. Did we ever think we would see a Beetlejuice sequel? Not just with Keaton coming back, but a Tim Burton-directed Beetlejuice sequel 36 years later.
They could have restarted this, right? They could have gone to the well and saw some comedian on TV and plucked him into the Beetlejuice role, put someone else in the Winona Ryder role, and made a brand new version of it. But they decided to do this. And no, to answer your question, I didn't think. Now, we had heard for years and years and years that there was one in the pipeline. Seth Graham Smith had written a script. Burton had done one with Michael McDowell, as we discussed at the end of last week's show. But I didn't think I would ever see one. And then they announced the musical, and I think that's what kind of got the fire in their asses to think, you know what, we could probably still do this. But no, I thought maybe they would bring a new director in. I thought Burton would probably produce it, but to get the band back together, as they say, I didn't think we would see this.
Yeah, and I didn't either, especially when you look at that. I mean, this one feels like a long time, but Tim Burton hasn't done a movie in 5 years, and he's kind of lowered his output quite a bit. Yeah, he's done Wednesday for Netflix, which kind of seems like the impetus for this with everybody involved. But the rumor's been there for so long, and much like things like Nightmare Before Christmas 2 and all these other movies, starting in September, you get these stupid, idiotic, fake fan-made posters of sequels, and that's been going on for decades. So until I sat down, I don't care if I saw it week two, until I sat down and saw the credits come up, I still didn't believe it was a Beetlejuice Beetlejuice.
What's funny, I looked at the marketing for this movie and thought it was actually made by fans, and then I realized, oh, this is the actual movie. Speaking of development, that's the place where we gotta begin. Because, as we alluded to, Beetlejuice was a hit, and they fast-tracked the sequel, so much so they had two scripts written by the time 1990 concluded. So post-Batman, Warren Scorin wrote a script called Beetlejuice and Love, which apparently was about someone named Leo, who died while proposing to his girlfriend and fell off the Eiffel Tower. Yeah, there's the afterlife. And Beetlejuice basically cons him, works his way into the land of the living, and goes after the girlfriend that's still alive. But Warren Scorin passed not too long after he turned in his script, so that kind of fell by the wayside. And then Tim Burton hired another writer named Jonathan Gems, who he would later work with on Mars Attacks. he had also written a script for an adaptation of George Orwell's 1984. This is where Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian first surfaced. Jens's quote, if you listen to interviews with him, because Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian has been talked about for decades. Even up until this was actually announced, that name still had some resonance, and people thought they were actually going to adapt that. But he said, Tim thought it would be funny to match the surfing backdrop of the beach movie with German expressionism, because they're totally wrong together. He's not incorrect, but if you've seen the dream fantasy musical number in Sweeney Todd, you kind of already seen what that's going to look like, at least through the Tim Burton lens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like to read scripts to prepare for these. I like to read the original scripts. I never did get to read this particular script, but it sounds awful. Just the concept of taking this property to a beach just sounds awful to me. I could not imagine. Maybe with Tim Burton's sensibilities, it could have worked. Who knows? Especially, you know, the early 90s Tim Burton. But the more I heard about that, I definitely was like, no, keep that the fuck away.
Yeah, and that was the biggest rumor for the longest time, is that Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian is getting made. Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian is getting made. Like, whenever there was sequel talk, that's the one they kept going back to. And then every now and then somebody would ask Kevin Smith about it, because he was brought into Warner Brothers at a time to look at scripts, and that was one that he famously was asked to look at. And every time it keeps coming back up, and thank goodness that didn't happen. But it does really seem like a Tim Burton-y thing to do. You know, just like, hey, you know what? I just am in the mood to burn this to the ground. I feel like that's Tim Burton sometimes.
Yeah.
It sounds like him saying, I'll do it, but don't expect something to be good. And you can't blame me if it's bad, because this is what you wanted. So he kind of had that out if it actually got made. Before Kevin Smith got involved, going to Batman Returns, Burton asked Daniel Waters at one point to do a rewrite of Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian. And then the producer hired someone from SNL and Troop Beverly Hills to do the rewrite. They asked Kevin Smith to rewrite the script. He said no, because he wanted to do Superman. And we all know how that went based on our conversation last year. And Kevin Smith is quoted as saying, didn't we say all we needed to say in the first Beetlejuice? Must we go tropical? The answer to that question is yeah, up until about 2022.
First time that Garrett ever agreed to Kevin Smith.
Yeah.
So by the time the late 90s came around, it kind of died off. Someone said its name three times, and instead of appearing, it went away. And Tim Burton started making movies basically from Planet of the Apes on. His whole approach was, I'm going to take existing properties and just Burtonize them. Sleepy Hollow, Planet of the Apes, Willy Wonka, Sweeney Todd, Alice in Wonderland. Another property he did that with, Dark Shadows, was getting worked on around 2012. Hired Seth Graham Smith, who wrote such great works as Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, and Abe Lincoln Vampire Hunter. Yes, that second one is an actual movie, in case you all forgot.
Adaptation.
Yeah. I had to review it.
Actually. He signed on. He wanted to do something with this idea, but he said, we can't recast this. We need Michael Keaton back. Burton and Keaton said in about 2012, we've not signed on, but we'll return if the script was good enough. And here's the funny thing. By the time this movie actually went into development, you could argue Michael Keaton has become a bigger star than he was at the time when he made Beetlejuice. He has had one of the great surprising resurgences for the last decade plus. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. Birdman, and of course he was in Spotlight, and of course he was in one of the Spider-Man movies a few years ago. Like, he had a real career renaissance. And then of course, you know, you have what we discussed last year, Flash, but with that aside, he became once again a bankable star, and this guy had disappeared for years. And you're right, if they had made this in the 90s, around the time he did Jack Frost, for Christ's sake, this thing would have died of painful death, I think. But no, he is back to being a bankable star, and it could be argued he's probably the biggest star in this cast, which is why he's top billed, even though he gets 16 minutes of screen time, but we'll get to that.
And I'll say, I don't think this role should have ever been recast, regardless if this got made 10 years later, because asking someone to replicate that performance, it would have felt like a really bad impression in all likelihood. But people are always going to say, well, Michael Keaton's in his 60s now. I mean, now he's in his 70s. We'll talk about his performance once we get into this movie. But it's just funny that a couple of years after this, Michael Keaton has Birdman. As you mentioned, he has Spider-Man, Spotlight, Founder. He had a couple of big TV projects. Like, he has become, obviously not quite to the level of Robert Downey Jr., but he's had a similar resurgence, because people forget, once the late 90s rolled around, he kind of faded into obscurity. I think the last big thing he did was like Jackie Brown. Mm. From that Night Shift to Jackie Brown, that's like his peak. And then he had the cameo mm-hmm. where he played the same character in Out of Sight. And then he was doing stuff like Herbie Fully Loaded, and he did this terrible movie called Postgrad, where he played the dad. And I'm like, oh, this is where broken actors go to collect a check. But as luck would have it, his career was on the up and up. Tim Burton, while his movies had never tapered off as far as box office, Dark Shadows kind of came and went. He did Big Eyes for the Weinsteins, which is a lot different than a lot of the projects he had done because it was biographical.
And he reunited with the screenwriters of Ed Wood, too, which was the big thing with that one.
You know, and people thought that was going to be a big awards contender. It won some things here and there, but I don't think it was going to be the big prestige piece because that came out the same year as Birdman and Boyhood, ironically. Well, a writer was asked about mm-hmm. it around the same time, and she said, I'm kind of sworn to secrecy, but I love that character, so I would love to come back and do it. But again, she also reiterated, I would come back if Burton and Keaton are involved.
For the longest time, I mean, she always worked, but she was probably the riskiest attachment that you could get after it. I mean, there was a time where she was extremely problematic, and it's amazing. This entire movie is almost about resurgences and people whose careers have come back.
Yeah, ask the surveillance people at Saks how dangerous she is. As big of a Winona fan as I am, she's also had a mini resurgence, though, because don't forget, not only was she in a movie we'll discuss next year, J.J. Abrams' Star Trek, in a pivotal role.
Like, not really.
Yeah, exactly. I know, that was the joke. It was sarcasm, Matt. Relax. She was cast in Stranger Things, and I think that's what got people to re-notice her. And then she had a meme spread around of her acting weird at the Emmys, but her resurgence is real. I think she's another one. Not as big as Keaton, she's also had a mini career resurgence as well.
Well, it also helped that there was a lot of Lydia in the character she played in Stranger Things to a certain degree.
Oh, yeah.
And she even said, I'll do Stranger Things, but under the guise of, if a Beetlejuice sequel ever happens, and I'm filming this, that I will go away and work on that. And the Duffer Brothers?
The yeah.
Behind that, they said, yeah, absolutely. And then she said, yeah, I'm coming back, right as the first season dropped. Burton said, yep, it's coming together. And then they shelved the sequel in 2019. So that previously rewritten script by the Abe Lincoln Vampire Hunter writer, that was shelved. It sat. The pandemic happened. And Brad Pitt's studio was the one that picked it up alongside Warner Brothers.
Yeah, I saw that name show up in the producing credits, and I looked at Jen. I'm like, holy shit, Brad Pitt produced this, of all people.
Burton said, I'm not involved. And then a couple days later, he said, well, nothing's out of the question, which is code for they caved into his salary demands in all likelihood.
Yep.
You mentioned Wednesday. That was Tim Burton sort of coming back to form in a lot of ways because he's so suited for that material to the point where you go back in the 90s and you're like, oh, that's right, he did not direct the Addams Family movies with mm-hmm. Angelica Houston and Raul Julia. That was Barry Sonnenfeld, of all people. But his star in that role, Jenna Ortega, she was attached to this. And that was kind of the, for all intents and purposes, the deciding factor on the part of the studio to get this made.
It was either that or the musical. I think the musical has something to do with it too, because that got a little bit of buzz when the musical came out in 2019, I believe. And we talk about Wednesday. We watched that a couple years ago. And Matt, you and I have discussed this 100 times. We talked about it with Batman a lot. In the last 20 or so years, he has been reserved to just burning up, as you mentioned, the Disney aesthetic and putting his name and stamp on things like Alice in Wonderland. Then he had Dumbo, which really didn't have much of his style in it at all.
Bombed. But,
yeah.
But I will say, of all the Disney live-action remakes, we've gotten a lot of them. I think that's one of the better ones because it's actually different.
You know what? I saw it in theaters, and I haven't revisited it. I remember liking it much more than its reputation, I'll say that much. But when Wednesday hit, and he had directed that pilot, that felt like Burton unfiltered. That felt like Burton getting away from Disney. And there is a jab at Disney in this movie. And I feel like this is Burton in, once again, Batman Returns mode, where he's just kind of going back to the meanness that decorated that movie. And you know what? I was excited for that. I was excited to see what he could do with this now that he was away from Disney and its restraints. He's with Warner Brothers in this film.
Speaking of jabs at Disney, that's the whole point of Dumbo. Disney produced that movie, and it's also a critique of Disney.
Yeah.
As the, you know, conglomerate. I mean, Michael Keaton is basically playing an exaggerated Walt Disney in that, which is cool that they made something before they went back to this. And then all the people Tim Burton is associated with said, yep, we're coming back to Danny Elfman, said he was doing the music. The Wednesday creators, Alfred Goh and Miles Millar, who Garrett knows and loves from Smallville, they came to write the script. And as luck would have it, for those of you who don't know, Tim Burton and Helena Bonham Carter are no longer an item, which is why Monica Bellucci is in this movie, because she is now with Tim Burton.
Yes.
Because you know damn good and well, if he was still with Helena Bonham Carter, she would have played this role, no questions asked.
Absolutely. And you mentioned Addams Family. God, did I get Addams Family vibes from her casting in this.
And then everyone else, like Catherine O'Hara, said, yep, I'm in it. There was the elephant in the room of Jeffrey Jones. I assumed they would just not reference him whatsoever. They would just say he died.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too.
Which we'll talk about how that's handled in the movie. But when the marketing came out and the trailers were unleashed, Adam, what were your thoughts when you first saw the marketing? Because I know you saw the trailers, unlike Garrett, who's really stayed away.
Yeah, and I was like, all right, let's see. You know, it was always the, can't believe they're doing this, can't believe they're doing this. Hey, it's really happening. And then I saw it, and I went, okay. There wasn't really much of it that excited me in the way that it was done. From some of the look of it to even the way that Beetlejuice was portrayed in the trailer, I thought was off. I don't know. Everything just seemed a little askew from what I was expecting. There were a few nice shots, there were a few things, but the trailers did not jazz me up for this movie, sadly.
Garrett, have you seen any of the marketing before you saw the movie?
I saw a couple posters. No, you know what? I think I saw the first teaser that they released, and it was getting a lot of good buzz. But other than that, I didn't see the second trailer, and every other piece of marketing I stayed way far away from. I knew next to nothing about this when I walked into that theater. Other than, as we mentioned, the band is back.
Yeah, I mean, that might as well be the subtitle of this movie.
Yeah.
Getting the band back together. I'm in the same boat as Adam, the same banana boat, if you will. Applause for you to he's got a staple gun and staple. He wants to staple my mouth shut like Monica Bellucci in this movie. But I thought it looked kind of sad and pathetic. I hate to be that negative. This feels like when you go to your high school reunion and you feel like it's going to be like the old days, and then everyone shows up looking old and tired, and you're just like, why did they even bother coming? That's kind of the rationale I had watching this trailer. Didn't excite me at all. And as we talked about, I am so done with these legacy sequels. I think there's been one great one, and that's it. At least that directly comes to mind. I'm sure if I go through the list, I'll find a couple I like, but I think there's one out and out. This is how you do it. But comedies are already hard enough, and they're as notorious for having bad sequels as any other genre, let alone one coming out 35 years later, because we saw what happened 20 years later when they did the sequel to Dumb and Dumber.
Oh, God.
Among other ones that they've done. But that was what I was worried this was going to be perfectly honest. So I went in, no expectations.
When you have a dramatic change in the way that comedy is told, I don't mean that to be the way that so many people are like, oh, you can't be funny anymore, you can't tell jokes, you can't do... No, things change and things shift. And the type of script that you write in the mid-80s isn't the script that you write in the mid 2020s. Oh my God, I sound so old. So it's just, I think that they were wise to bring the writers in that they did, because I do think you got to change it up. But I also think that the two people that you brought on, I think they're a little long in the tooth to write this kind of movie. I mean, Smallville was over 20 years ago at this point, and Wednesday is kind of a different thing. Long in the tooth, I think, might be the most apropos thing. With everything else that went on, including Wednesday, I do think it was Stranger Things that really made this movie happen.
Oh, interesting. Goff and Millar have been working a lot since Smallville, so it's not just that they hung their head on that. And they did know Burton very well by working with him with Wednesday. I think if you listen to interviews with him, they've been on Rosenbaum's podcast a few times, and they mentioned that they just jived with Burton like the second they met him, and that's something that Burton doesn't really find too often. He goes through a lot of screenwriters in his career, and if I didn't have confidence in this movie, which I really didn't. I had next to zero expectations as well. I thought it would at least be clever, and the fact that Burton was back to add his aesthetic to something that, as we mentioned last week, really hit me with how much fun I had, and that viewing and that podcast that I recorded, it was fresh on my mind when I went into this screening yesterday. I was fit to, if not enjoy the story or whatever that is told, at least have fun. And that's what I was expecting.
I agree on those interviews with Al and Miles, because if you listen to Inside of You, which it, with Rosenblatt, one of my favorite podcasts, I freaking love it. Those two talking about work, and that's the first that I heard that this was truly a go. They were passionate about it. Their excitement had me excited more than almost anything, because you could tell that they cared. I don't know them from much outside of that. But yeah, those two seem to really have a passion for at least what they were doing.
And we'll talk about them later this year, because they're part of our last retrospective.
Yes, they are.
We won't say what that is just yet, but it's in the same way that this is perfect for Halloween, that's going to be a perfect franchise for Christmas time. So I went to see this. I went by myself.
Aw.
And it was like me walking into a Hot Topic, which... It made me realize you guys felt old. Like, I walked in, I'm like, what the hell happened to me? I used to be it was like that for you guys. We walked in, it was a sheer culture shock.
Well, me and Jen saw this last night as we record this, and we like to go out to dinner and have a theme associated with the movie that we're seeing, and she chose sushi for this movie because of the scene in the first film. And we went to a theater. It was, and this movie, at the time we record this, it's been out a couple weeks. There were about 15 people in that theater, and they were having a good time. We heard a lot of laughter.
I saw it also last night. Unfortunately, I had to wait, and I had to see it alone, which was unfortunate. I was hoping and planning for this to be a family movie. Unfortunately, we had camping last weekend for Scouts. We got camping this weekend for Scouts. We got a coastal cleanup. We got meetings. So the only way that I was going to get in to watch was me going by myself, which I did. Went to a 6:30 showing on a Wednesday, and I was one of four people in that movie theater. Though they were doing a Transformers 1, Transformers Prime, whatever the new animated movie is. They were doing giveaways and stuff at my AMC. I could not talk them out of the comic and poster they were giving out, the cheap bastards. But
were they giving out refunds for the bad Transformers movies?
But I walked into Beetlejuice by people literally dressed up as Bumblebee.
Oh my God.
Starscream. Yeah, it was kind of crazy, and I didn't realize that movie was coming out. Got my large popcorn, got my icy, and I was ready to go. I was happy that I was getting to see it, though I did wish that I got it with a fuller crowd.
A couple of things. One, I love the fact that you saw it on a Wednesday. That's funny to me. I don't know. Both of us saw it on Wednesday,
oh my God,
which is wonderful. And two, we walked by the Transformers 1 standee, and I looked at Jen. I said, you know, Jen, we got to see that next week because we got to review it. And the look of disdain on her face could not have been worse.
Because we could have just left well enough alone with Michael Bay being put out to pasture.
No, nope. As long as they keep releasing them, we'll be there.
All right, well, speaking of things that are put out to pasture, let's talk about
this
movie.
Let's do it. Hey, don't say that. This movie, as Adam mentioned last week, this movie is a certified hit. And you said this has already made over $200 million, which is insane to me. So let's see what everybody is talking about.
For a movie that, at first, they were like, sure, we'll make it for Mac. And it was like, no, you are not going to make it for Mac. It's funny, though, because you see these articles, they're like, ooh, Tim Burton doesn't do TV. And somebody's too stupid to realize what Wednesday is. I'll say I give him credit that it's like, yes, we'll do it for this. Yes, if you wanted to go to theaters, you got to cut your budget by a third. And I supposedly and reportedly, that's what they did. They got it down to 100 million as opposed to 150, 140. Yep. And budget-wise, Zaslav be damned, this thing is a hit.
Also worth noting, speaking of that, that if they're upset about HBO Max being a bad business model, Wednesday was the highest viewed show in the history of Netflix when it first dropped. So you don't think Max would have wanted Tim Burton on their server?
Of course.
Bitch, please. Please. The movie started, but not before 20 minutes of fucking previews again, which I will always complain about that until something changes.
Jen was so funny because she goes, why are all these previews advertised to kids? Because we had like the Snow White trailer. We had all trailers geared towards kids, which we found a little odd.
I noticed that as well. And a lot of mine were Disney-related, even though this was a Warner Brothers production.
Mm-hmm. And that's surprising. At least half were Disney movies. And there's sometimes you'll squeeze in one or two that they paid for. But Warner Brothers has enough that I'm surprised it wasn't 90% Warner trailers. And yet, 35 minutes.
Wow.
35 minutes before I saw Nicole Kidman up on screen. And they had a new AMC, thanks for coming to AMC beforehand. So I was like, oh, Nick's finally gone back down under. Nope. She has risen. She is still there.
Well, speaking of saying things repeatedly, we open, much like the first movie, with credits over what we think is the town, only to find out it's not what it appears to be. We get all the names, same font, I mean, it's the same theme, and I started rolling my eyes going, oh God, it's going to be one of those movies where it's just hitting all the notes, literally.
Well, he changed a little bit of it. I noticed it. Elfman changed the opening theme a bit. He added a couple little beats here and there. But you're right. We're getting right back into this world. It's been 35 years, Matt. And a lot of the people in the theater, you said it yourself, you were probably the oldest person there. So if you haven't been familiar with the font before, if you haven't been familiar with the feel before, you're going to be familiar with it now. But you know what? The first movie is on HBO Max, so people coming in were probably pretty fresh on the first one like we were, and this lets them sink right back into what they were familiar with.
Well, I seriously hope people have seen the first movie without going into this one, because goddamn, go into this movie cold, good luck. Much like the first movie, though, where we think we're seeing the town and it turns out to
did
be
you
a
notice,
model.
Did you notice the only shot of the protagonist from the first film in that part? There were models on the right outside the house. Did you guys notice that, or am I the only one?
No, I didn't notice that, but I'm also, in a way, I'm kind of happy that they didn't find a way to shoehorn Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin mm-hmm. into this movie.
Yeah, me too.
There's one line where they found a way to, like, cheat the system, I guess.
One of them gets a cameo. But yeah, I was looking during this opening flyover, because I was like, oh, they're hiding little stuff, little Easter eggs. So I was really paying attention to this town, much to my chagrin. Nope, it's just a town, for the most part.
I was quoting Patsy from Monty Python, it's only a model. But it literally is, because this is the precursor to the show Ghost House, which is how we're reintroduced to Lydia, played by a grown-up Winona Ryder now, where she has become the host of a supernatural talk show, and she's in the middle of a segment where we realize that she is suffering in a certain way, much like Cole from The Sixth Sense, where she keeps seeing dead people and she doesn't know
why. Well, a couple things on this. One, I think it is a legitimate jump to assume that this goth girl from 36 years ago would be doing this. This feels very, very apropos. Number two, I love the opening Easter egg, or the second Easter egg, I guess, in naming the show Ghost House, because that was one of the original titles of the original Beetlejuice that the studio was pitching. So I think this is Burton already taking a jab at the studio system and where he came from.
Can I say the elephant in the room?
Yeah.
To start. So, I've talked about this with a lot of these movies we've reviewed, Terminator, Dark Fate, Star Wars The Last Jedi. Once again, we are reintroduced to a character whose life has gone to shit when we have re-met them. I am so tired of this trope, and I'm going to be honest, this does not feel like the same Lydia from the previous movie. I can't believe this is the same character.
I don't think her life has turned to shit. I think she's in a life that she's not happy with, but that doesn't necessarily mean... I mean, she's on TV. People know her. She's obviously made some money, and Justin Theroux, your boyfriend, is profiting off of her, but I don't think she's actually turned to shit. You know, this isn't Indiana Jones just kind of slinking in where he lives that we saw last year.
Another one.
This isn't that. And, you know, let's talk about Winona Ryder right off the bat, because they do something weird with this character. You know, in the very beginning, she really comes off as a pushover, and that was in my notes. I had scribbled on my notes, I said, God damn, this character just gets pushed over so much. She's pushed over by her own daughter that we'll see. She's pushed over by her boyfriend here. And I'm thinking, well, her arc is she's going to stop being a pushover. Because at one point, Catherine O'Hara tells her, look, I want to see that goth girl who said her piece 30 years ago. And I think that's where her arc is going to go. But it really doesn't go there. I like the fact that Winona Ryder's here. I do like certain places that her character goes. But I am not unhappy at the fact that she starts very low. I'm unhappy at the fact that they really don't know what to do with her.
Yeah, well, the problem, before I go to Adam, is that she has no agency as a character throughout most, if not all, of this movie. And that'd be fine if the purpose of her arc was her sort of reclaiming her life. But this movie's preoccupied with so many other things that gets lost in the shuffle. I think Winona Ryder's good as far as the performance goes, but I do feel a certain disconnect with Lydia that I sometimes have to remind myself this is the same character. Adam, where do you stand?
it starts off and I'm like, okay, interesting choice. And I love the Ghost House joke. That is so deep, deep inside. We didn't discuss that a week ago. I don't know if we didn't remember it ourselves, but I love that. From the hairdo and the bad wig, I mean, she hasn't changed her hair since she was 15 to, it seems like she's putting on an act for the TV show, but that act is who she really is. I'll say, I think the first half of this movie, and I'm going to say it right now, is from a combination of multiple scripts. And I think it's pretty sloppy. I think the agency is lacking, and I think the characterizations for a couple people are all over the place, and I think you got two characters that are giant, frickin' sink me to the bottom of the ocean anchors that show up, and they show up, unfortunately, pretty damn early in this film. Not Winona Ryder. She's good, but I think it takes a long time before they give her some enjoyable space inside this film.
So you touched on a point that I think is valid, in my opinion. This movie does feel like they took five different Beetlejuice scripts, and now that they finally had the impetus to make the movie, they just crammed everything in because they know they're not going to have another shot after this and all like
feeling. That's what I feel, too. There's no way you can go through 36 years of development and not have that feel. How many writers have gone through this? How many times have we spoken about this on previous retrospectives that we've done? Go back to Alien 3, for Christ's sake. There's a certain amount being put here that was not there before. And to jumble and mix all of that into one script, I'll go ahead and say right now, I think this movie is chock full of too many plots. And I think there had to be some decisions being made. Because we mentioned last week that 90 minutes flew by so quick last week. And this movie is longer. Not much longer, but it is longer. And I do feel like one or two plots could have been discarded and we could have had a more streamlined story.
I'm in agreement on all those points. But I also think Burton is really using Lydia as his avatar for this movie as far as whether he intended this or not when he was making his movies. There was a point where his movies felt very mechanical and, I guess, by the book. I mean, it's literally personified. Watch the opening credits of Willy Wonka, his Willy Wonka remake, where everything is CG overload and it's literally a printing press, like at a factory. That's what so much of his modern filmmaking has been, and Lydia is kind of being repressed by the powers that be in certain ways to do this cliche thing of, like, Ghost House, which you could, and The Supernatural, which you could put Tim Burton in that box as well. So I think he's doing some reflection in this movie, but that mirror keeps getting fogged up by about 10 other people trying to look at themselves. So much so that the next scene is Lydia going into the bathroom, and it's not bad enough that she's being repressed by her boyfriend. She's also taking pills. Not exactly in a good place.
Yeah, that would have been a plot point somewhere down the line, but it's never brought up again other than, I'm going to bring it up right here, the most annoying, most kill-him-off-please 5 minutes into this movie character in Justin Theroux, this Rory character is just... God, every time he was on screen, I wanted to get up and go refill my fucking soda just to get away from him. But it seems like there was something here with the pills, but it never shows up again.
And the fact that they go into the fucking bathroom wastebasket and he picks it up and puts it in her mouth, I almost gagged when I saw that. I was like, oh, that's so gross.
Did you hate his performance as much as Adam did?
I, in fact, found him to be a foil that, you know, I mean, let's put it this way. I don't think Lydia is ever going to find love. I think what she found is somebody who exploits her. And I think this character is a foil for her to realize that, you know what, I had a kid with somebody who I ended up not loving. This character is somebody who kind of got my career on the roll, but I'm not loving him as well. I think this is her just not finding what she needs in her life. And we're going to see throughout the course of this movie that she finds that she has people around her who are using her. Where's she going to go? Beetlejuice, for Christ's sake? Like, this character is her realizing that it's not going to be here. And then she has a daughter who thinks that she does find love. So I think there's a little bit of trickery going on here as far as where the character goes. But I like Justin Theroux in this movie. His sliminess is kind of what the kind of character that we saw in Christopher Walken when we reviewed Batman Returns a couple years ago. I really enjoyed seeing him on screen. And the motivations that he has are way different than what Lydia's are. And that's what I found to be interesting. But Adam's right to this extent. I don't think his total arc serves the movie's ending very well. But I did enjoy his presence.
He's Bob Iger if Lydia is Tim Burton. He's Bob Iger.
Oh, here we go.
Like, oh my God, I'm going to suckle on. You had a hit. that made $1.5 billion with Alice, and now I'm going to attach myself to you like a fucking dick.
I knew that was coming as soon as Disney was referenced. I'm like, here comes the Bob Iger dig. I agree with Garrett. I think in a movie that is pretty inconsistent, he was one of the things that actually routinely made me laugh with some of the parts that come up later on, because he's ultimately a con man, as we'll find out. In a lot of ways, though, his character reminds me a lot of the characters in Mars Attacks, where they're just deplorable and entirely unsympathetic. I think Burton's kind of tapping into that worldview once again. Much like Beetlejuice, everyone who's alive is either a shill or just routinely unlikable. And everyone who's dead aren't the people you actually want to be with. Lydia gets a call from her stepmother. We're reintroduced to Catherine O'Hara as Delia, who, in one of the funniest jokes in the movie, her art has made her incredibly successful. The hipsters have won. The hipsters have won.
I love Catherine O'Hara in this movie. It might be my favorite performance in the movie, actually.
I agree, until something happens at the end where I thought it was way too absurd.
I agree with that.
Even for this movie, I thought she showed up to play, and much like Justin Theroux being a foil, I even like the line she has. We only started liking each other when you sold out.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we find out that, okay, how are we going to address the Jeffrey Jones situation? So, part A is he did die. And you think that's going to be the end of him. Well, not exactly. Because we cut to a stop motion or a claymation sequence where it
this was insane.
Indistinguishably Jeffrey Jones' likeness.
Yes.
Where his plane crashes in the Amazon and he's eaten by a shark. Now, in a way, that's kind of, that's so mean-spirited that it's befitting what Jeffrey Jones did in real life, that I think there's a lot of people who would like to see him get eaten by a shark. But I thought that was going to be the end of it. I had no idea where they were going with this, and it was kind of shocking how much he's actually a character in this movie, albeit indirectly.
Agreed. That blew me away. This moment when it turned to claymation, I couldn't believe they used his likeness. I wonder if people who are not as knowledgeable understand why they went this route with it. I just wonder if that's lost on other people. I thought it was quaint, cute, and, you know, you bring in that stop motion claymation, I'm always going to be a sucker for it. And then I'm floored because I've read the story before that this is Tim Burton's biggest nightmare, that he survives a plane crash just to get eaten by a shark.
Oh, interesting. I found one of the most, if not the most brilliant piece of dark humor Burton has ever done to be at the expense of this arc. And what I mean is, when known pedophile Jeffrey Jones is lowered into the grave and being serenaded by a kid choir singing Deo, I laughed my fucking ass off. I thought, my God, that was fucking brilliant. Burton knows what he's doing here. Burton knows what he's dealing with when it comes to this fucking asshole. And the way he deals with it just made me laugh so fucking hard. I could not stop laughing. Matt, did you pick up on that?
Yes, and the icing on the cake, his tombstone is a shark fin.
Yes.
I love that. It took me a little bit of seeing it more than once before I realized it, but that was great.
I appreciated, this is very much Tim Burton in Batman Returns mode, where he is being very mean-spirited.
Yes.
And there is that dark, if you like dark humor, I think there's a lot in this movie that you like. I mean, this is certainly much more, it captures the tone in a lot of ways of the first film, but it also kind of ups the ante as far as being just garish and cruel.
Yeah, this is Burton unhinged. And guess what? I love when Burton's unhinged. Stuff like this is what made him a really enjoyable director for me to follow when his career was really getting going. And we talked about this with Batman Returns. There were parts of Batman Returns that almost seemed like they were too mean. Like when he throws the batarang and it hits that chick and she falls off the roof. I mean, that is deep, fucking mean-spirited shit. Here, he is mean, but he is taking his jabs where he can, and the jabs he's taking are actually very, very funny. Matt, me and you talked about this when Wednesday was on. Me and you text each other saying, wow, Burton's back. I think Burton's back with this movie, and it's awesome not having him tied to the Disney logo with this.
Well, it was also a creative way to get the obvious out of the room, but it also only works because, like, the Jeffrey Jones, that broke, what, 20 years ago? So enough time has passed, and it was not the level of a Harvey Weinstein or a Kevin Spacey where it was like a big scandal. It was aware, and then it just sadly kind of fell off because so much more horrible shit has happened, unfortunately. But I thought this was tasteless in the proper way, and also pretty creative to explain not just why he's dead, but also the extremes that they go, I think is one of the funniest set pieces and bits of writing in the movie.
Me too. The fact that he's bitten in half and his lower half comes in and there's blood spurting everywhere and every time he talks it's gurgled. This movie's PG-13. It feels like it pushed that rating very, very high.
I've seen horror films that have not had this much gore.
Exactly.
I was shocked at how much blood was in this movie, but they get around it because it's that Sweeney Todd just red paint aesthetic. Yeah. Like it's got the Hammer horror shine to it, and it's also not entirely realistic, so that's how you get around the R rating. Speaking of R, that means we have to go and get the family together, because R for Richard, who died. So we're introduced to their daughter, Astrid, played by the aforementioned Jenna Ortega, where I got a little worried for her opening scene where she gets pranked by the mean girls at the prep school, and she has almost a Wednesday Addams-esque comeback. I was worried she was just going to play Wednesday Addams throughout this entire movie, but I was thankful that she gets a little bit more animated as the movie goes on.
And never having seen Wednesday yet, I love that comeback because this shit that just made me laugh. And as somebody who went to high school with a bunch of mean girls, yeah, that's exactly who they turned out to be, where she puts them in their place. But yeah, I'm really glad that this isn't who she is the whole time. Though I'll say, it takes a lot of this movie before she's actually given some substance.
But once she is, it's very welcomed. I'm with Adam. I think she is amazing in this movie. I adore her in this.
Yeah, if you can make it to the 50-minute mark, this movie gets good.
Her subplot that she'll get involved with later on was the one I was most interested in, and I was disappointed that it's resolved the quickest.
Oh, wow. I'll hold my thoughts until we get there. But I enjoy her in this, and Adam, if you enjoy her in this, you got to check out Wednesday.
I just think it's one that is a family, like we should, at least Laura and I, like, let's just sit and enjoy it. Yeah, yeah.
So Astrid, obviously not on good speaking terms with her mom because she won't answer the call, so they literally just drive up to pick her up.
I love her avatar on her phone. It's called Alleged Mom.
Yeah.
It rang. Mom. It's so funny.
But this is also very much Tim Burton's touch of broken families and estranged parental relationships. I mean, that's the whole point of Big Fish. You've seen that movie, which is one of the most manipulative movies ever made. But it will get you.
Yeah, that movie kills me now. I can't watch that movie now.
There's parts of that movie I haven't seen it in a very long time, but I remember being the last 20 minutes, I was like, oh God, this is manipulative, but it's working. And it works here because they cut and we see Beetlejuice on full display. He's basically Freddy Krueger.
Yeah.
with how he's depicted early on before we actually get reintroduced to him. But I thought the setup of her still, like, obviously this sexual predator for all intents and purposes who went out and tried to marry a teenage girl. Yeah, I could see how that would resonate with you 30-plus years later.
Yeah. I've had an obsession with Winona Ryder for 30 years as well. So I understand him in this plight. But I like the way he is brought back in because, correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, or maybe Adam, since you saw it as recently as I did, the whole place where he's at is on strike, correct? That's why he's able to run it.
Honestly, can't remember, but I know that he puts himself out as a bioexorcist.
Yes.
But, you know, I think it's at least dropped in this movie because that's why the line's not moving throughout is, yeah, I believe that what's her name that looks like she's from Hot Dog on a Stick behind the counter says that they're on strike. I think you're right.
So I like the fact that that's how he is able to pretty much rule the roost, as they say.
But he makes a comment to Bob or one of the other heads that, oh, she definitely saw me this time. So he's got a way that he's able to kind of project himself into the living space, but we never get an explanation as to what, how, why, or anything else to that, other than just Lydia can see ghosts. But he's doing something, but we don't understand what it is.
Or how his head was grown back. Look, I'm not preoccupied with answering those questions. Look, this movie explains a lot of shit, and that's one of the things I did not need explained. But the family decides, reluctantly, we got to come back together, go back to Winter Rivers to properly bury him. And then we cut to the afterlife, where we see the obligatory Danny DeVito cameo.
Wow.
It took me a few seconds to recognize him. I had to look, and of course, once you look at him for longer than a few seconds, you see him right away. But I was like, is that Danny DeVito? And then I looked at Jenna, I'm like, that's Danny DeVito, right? She's like, oh yeah. I'm like, holy shit.
Yeah, especially
interesting makeup job.
With when you got the opening credits and you got the with this person, and that person, I'm really glad they left him out until the end credits because we had no idea here. And I mean, good little spot for him. He even has spittle out of his mouth the exact same way he did as Penguin at one point. it's fitting for a role that's just a disgusting Tim Burton creature kind of role.
Bunch of boxes get knocked over, and teased this last week. I'm going to bitch about it now. In the previous movie, Beetlejuice having an ex-wife was a throwaway line and a gag that kind of came and went. But because this is a legacy sequel, we need to make everything that was referenced in the original movie important. So his ex-wife is a plot point in this movie, and I think it's the one of two things you could have cut, and the movie would be relatively better off without it. Not just because it's also a direct homage to Sally from The Nightmare Before Christmas. Tim Burton's got a stitching fetish. I don't know if we've come to terms with this. And I'm like, for God's sake, you just had to find a way to put your new muse in this movie because your other two muses, Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter, deleted your number.
Strong disagree. I think she is very pivotal in this movie. Now, here's where I was very afraid. I was afraid because you mentioned last week that there was a possibility that they were going to go into Beetlejuice's backstory. And I was a little afraid of that. However, the way she is injected in the story and the little bits that they give about what happened is just enough. For me, they don't go deep into it. There could be an argument to be made that she's not necessary here because she doesn't play as big of a role. I think that Monica Bellucci plays just a big enough role for me to really enjoy her in this movie. If there's any more or any less of her, I would agree with you, but I think she's fine here.
I just think she keeps coming and going so quickly that I sometimes forget she's in the movie.
I think that's kind of the point.
Yeah, but I think she should have been the driving antagonist of the movie based on at least structure. It would have been the one plot point you could have actually would have tied things together versus the other 5,000 that are happening in this movie.
That is a very, very valid point. However, I think that's the point of it, is the fact that you think she's going to play a bigger role, but she doesn't. And I think Alfred Goff and Miles Millar have a lot to do with this. They're kind of swerving you, right? This is the swerve, bro, to quote Vince Russo, where you think she's going to be the big bad, but she's not. And I'm fine with that because the little bit they give, and I love, you know, once we get to it, the commentary that Beetlejuice gives, you know, he gives it in Italian, and you know that's not Michael Keaton's voice, but who gives a shit? I think the way this is played off is very well done.
I really love when the body comes together, and I really loved it when I saw it in 2019's Hellboy with Mila Jovovich.
Oh, for fuck's sake. They literally rip
the entire, including what pieces are in what boxes, and stitching together. Like, that's the Blood Queen.
This has been done for years.
Yes,
they did it in fucking Frankenstein, too. Relax.
Oh, wait, guess what? This isn't 1930. This is 2020. And for a movie that was done just a few years ago, I mean, just because it's fucking Tim Burton doesn't make it irrelevant. I mean, it was done and literally chopped up, put into boxes, and it's just a little too much. Is it Sally? Yes, it is. That's Stitch Fetus, and everything is there. So my bitching about that, and I was like, guess what? I've seen this, but it's a great scene. It comes together wonderfully. Monica Bellucci is astounding. She's fantastic. She is a presence. I feel like they shoot it a little off because some scenes she glides into a room where I never think she's walking, and then other ones she's clearly walking. So it's almost like they filmed it differently and didn't have continuity. But I think she is great. I think what she does is fantastic. But I do think she should have been maybe a phantom for Lydia, because there should have been something a little more to her. But I think she's great. I love when she's in this. She looks absolutely amazing. Her characterization is great. Even when she, like, turns the wedding dress black just with a touch. She captivates every scene she's in. But I kind of realize she never is interacting with anybody in this film for the most part.
No.
With any of our main characters.
She's like reshoots.
Yeah, she's only ever in by herself and some prop. And that's a little awkward when you back it and realize it almost seems like an afterthought the way she was put in. Now, I know there was some strikes going on both in the writing and shooting. It seems cut a little weird. She doesn't seem to be interacting with our other characters. But I do think she's fantastic. The character of Dolores is great.
And they come up with a really cool ability of her sucking souls, which most women tend to do.
Took my line.
I think this is something about Tim Burton with Helena Bonham Carter putting this
one. Yeah, which is funny. I guarantee you, she watched this movie, watched Monica Bellucci, and she's like, I could have done this in my sleep.
I guarantee Helena Bonham Carter doesn't give a shit. I don't think she's even close to watching this movie.
She sucks Danny DeVito's soul and just deflates him, which is this. I guess that's her ability to suck souls. That's a cool effect. It looks pretty practical, which I will compliment this movie. I think the set design, the production design, A lot of the effects, there's a lot more practicality in them than I was expecting. So good job on that front, keeping practicals alive.
And I think it stands out because the times that they go digital instead of practical, it kind of throws you off a little bit. Because the practical, even when they're, I don't want to say cheap looking, but nostalgic looking, there's just a sense of happiness to that. And when they do digital, it's kind of like, eh, you cheapened out right there.
So she's on the hunt for the man himself when we're finally properly introduced to the title character. Although worth noting, he has as much screen time in this movie as he did in the previous film, and that was a purposeful choice by Burton and the writers.
I heard it was actually Michael Keaton who made that choice. He said, I will be in this, and this might have something to do with Dolores' reduced role, too. He said, I will be in this, but I don't want to be the center of it. I want to be exactly I was in the first one, which is given 14, 15, 16
I
minutes of screen time. That's
20
it.
$20 million in 15 minutes.
Exactly. Good for him.
Yep.
Good for him, and to his credit, he hasn't missed a beat.
Ooh. I'm going to disagree here. My biggest disappointment. Yeah.
Well, because you always agree with me on these fucking shows.
Well, no. Here's what I'll say. In rewatching that first movie, there was a manicness to Beetlejuice in that movie where it looked like Michael Keaton had done 6 grams of cocaine before he even stepped in front of the camera. There's one scene where I get that same energy, and we'll get to it when we get to it. But for the most part, I was kind of disappointed with Beetlejuice in this movie. I didn't think Michael Keaton was as much into this as he has implied in interviews. I find him kind of tuned out.
I think it takes a while to get it going. I'm not jazzed at first. But again, I'll say for like the third time, the first half of this movie, it's trouble to get through. Tell you what, because I looked at my watch, 35 minutes into the movie, one of the other three people in the theater started fucking snoring, which took me back to my Covenant watch. Thanks, dude, buddy. I'm glad he woke up. But this is slow, prodding, and badly written for the first while. And I do think it's just a combination of multiple scripts. It is a shitty opening to get this movie going. Before you really get going, it's not good. And I think that also shows in the performance because it doesn't fit in the end of the movie. And that includes here with Beetle. I think in a little bit, I think like the third time he shows up, I'm like, fuck, here we go. Now Keaton's on point. But I think the first little bit, I think he's off a little bit. So I love this room of Bob's, or Trunkenhead. They're not all Bob.
Oh, I love Bob. Bob is probably my favorite character in this movie.
Are they all love Bob? Okay.
Yeah, I think they all have name tags named Bob. But I think Beetlejuice gets better when he has to re-interact with the old characters.
Interacting. Yeah.
Because this feels still disparate from the actual A story, which just adds to my theory that this whole office of bio-exorcist, where he's running his own company, this feels like a leftover idea from previous scripts. What I was not expecting was a full homage to Mario Bava's Black Sunday.
Yes, and Kill Baby Kill. We'll get Kill Baby Kill, too, later on.
Which, as a film buff, I applaud this because I love Mario Bava.
Me too.
But I think that's a little too much inside baseball for U.S. modern film audiences who Mario Bava is. They'll say, oh yeah, he's the guy that jumps on Goombas, right? So this, I think it's a great reference. I love how it literally looks like that, where he's a grave robber during the Black Plague. They have the ridiculous sex scene. She kills him with a bottle labeled poison.
Yes.
That's straight out of like a Warner Brothers cartoon. I thought this was cute, but like I said, it may go over the heads of the intended audience.
For sure.
As far as what he's referencing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was surprised this was live action, because you already had the claymation stop motion early on, and you could have done this the same way. Like, I enjoyed this a lot, but I think we enjoy it because of just appreciating this type of stuff. I could imagine half the audiences being out there looking to their side going like, what the fuck is going on here? I can't imagine both my kids looking at me and going, Dad, what? It stops the film to tell this story.
Yeah, and we mentioned last week that last week's film didn't really stop, just kept going. And there are a lot of start stops here. And as I mentioned, maybe a few too many story beats. There were so many fucking plot points. At first, I was jealous that Matt was taking over these fucking plots for this series. But then when I came out of this movie, I went to Jenna. I'm like, thank God I'm not doing the plot to this, because there are so many A to B to Z's that I wouldn't know where the hell to start.
So he reveals that he met her during the Black Plague, but he killed her before the immortality ritual could take effect, so she's out for revenge, apparently. And he's interrogated by Willem Dafoe, who, how has it taken this long for Tim Burton to work with Willem Dafoe? You think these two would be made for each other in a lot of ways? You talk about superfluous. They got one joke with Willem Dafoe, and they just beat that into the fucking ground.
Big misstep is this fucking casting. I hate Willem Dafoe in this movie. And I like Willem Dafoe in a lot of things. And I was with you, Matt. I'm like, wow, I think this is a nice marriage. Willem Dafoe and Tim Burton. Where can this go? It goes nowhere. This is a character who, I mean, come on, this is somebody, I mean, Bruce Willis isn't fit to do anything now, but this is a washed up action star. Throw Schwarzenegger in this. Throw somebody here who could actually do something with it. Willem Dafoe has, as you mentioned, Matt, one beat and that's it. Every time he's on screen, I don't like it. This was a character I could have done without.
I was so glad to have this guy in here that I actually enjoyed seeing as opposed to every time they cut to Rory. So it took me like the first scene, I was like, oh man, I don't know. But the more that he's in, I just like every time that Wolf Jackson shows up on screen. I'm having fun. He's making me laugh more than some of the other characters we got.
He made me laugh the first time, and then that's it.
His makeup job's awful. All of the things about this character, associated with this character, I could have done without.
Well, I think his grenade wound is intentionally cheap-looking because he's a B-movie action star, so it matches like the effects you would see like a Chuck Norris movie. I think that's actually pretty clever, but they just don't have anything for this character. It's that one joke. Speaking of Johnny Depp, this is the role Johnny Depp would have played in this movie, and he functions entirely as the character that he played in Tusk, where he shows up and you're like, oh god, this is just nails on a chalkboard. I think you could have axed this entirely and the movie would have been better for it.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Good, we finally agree on something after all this argument. Although, give it 5 minutes, I'm sure I'll find something else. He tells him that his you seen this woman before? And he goes, never seen that chick before in my life. Or afterlife.
The practical effect of the big eyes bugging out, you know, going back, like we mentioned last time, looking like Large Marge and Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Like, you got some of those practical facials coming back out. Love it. Need more of that.
It tells them, you know, watch your ass and basically be on the watch. Then return to the land of the living. Was not a lot of the people in the theater, because I heard some snoring, too, for the first 45 minutes. And I couldn't believe the first 45 minutes I was checking my watch going, I hope this is under 2 hours. Thankfully it is, and the movie does improve, I will say. But it takes a long time for this movie to get its ass in gear. Even when we return to Winter River and they're doing the, as you mentioned, Garrett, them singing Deo, the orchestral quiet version. I thought this whole bit was hysterical. And then it's the priest. That guy's in a ton of stuff.
Yeah.
The doctor from Pacific Rim.
Wait a minute. Oh, I'm thinking of Man High Castle. That's what I really don't.
Is this supposed to be an homage to 1988? Because in his car, it's got the seatbelt that rotates when you open and close the door. Which they linger on a bit.
I remember those.
Yeah, I remember those too. And of course, you know, it's got to be the priest who has alcohol bottles in his fucking car. He plays up all the tropes.
I thought this was inspired casting. I thought this whole bit was funny. And they go to the house, and it's covered in, was it Cristal?
Yes.
Yeah, it's one artist. The house it looks like literally the house is in mourning. As much as the family is for the death of the patriarch.
It's incredible.
We're seeing Rory. Adam, I thought this was funny with him, with this, trying to be that reluctant stepdad.
Yes.
Or soon-to-be stepdad. And she's just having none of it, because he can't ad-lib a poem to save his life. Even though he looks like every hipster slam poet you would go see at a Starbucks working on their material.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's kind of the Otho of this movie in a lot of ways.
That's the connection I made. Ortho was here. This would be who he would be playing.
Both you can bite your tongue. I enjoyed Ortho last week.
No, I enjoyed Ortho last week, too. I said I did.
This guy, this man is no Ortho. And I will hate.
Help me, Ortho 1 Kenobi. You're my only Adam was muttering to himself. Rory takes the opportunity to propose to Lydia. Dick move, obviously. And she got a precious time to marry him on Halloween.
Yes.
Kind of bites her tongue, agrees to do it. Astrid sees right through this, gets on her bike, and walks onto the set of Stranger Things.
This was crazy, though. Remember when we talked The Force Awakens, we said that Harrison Ford came on screen, and we knew right away that there were sparrows around his head. When she gets on this bike, and she's avoiding this traffic, even when she hits this tree, she didn't move for a couple beats. I'm like, is she going to die and go to the afterlife? And then we'd have to find Lydia blaming herself and going right back into dispelling mode. But no, that's not what happens. But I got to tell you guys, that went through my mind as she's avoiding this traffic and getting to this treehouse.
Especially when you see the bridge.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. That was my other talking point, Matt, was she goes over the exact same bridge.
I totally thought that we might kill her off right here or send her to the afterlife, and that was going to kick the next part of the movie into gear. And tell you what, it's a brilliant distraction or brilliant decision. It's a swerve. You think that he's actually going to do it. And in this kind of movie, it makes sense because you could do it. And it would follow, and you could set a trajectory based on Killing Astrid here. So really well done. And it's amazing, because I think from this point, like, this is a delineation point. Everybody gets better from this point through the rest of the movie.
I was going to say, is this the point where you found it actually picking up?
From here, I literally want to walk out of my theater when it's the whole getting married and everything. I literally wanted to walk out at that point. Like, I'm having such a bad time. You're welcome, listeners. Donate. But from the point that she gets on the bike, I'm engaged. But I think everybody's performance is better, is nuanced, and is written, where I don't feel like that's happened up till this point.
Well, this is literally the shot in the arm the movie needs, where I'm like, oh, something actually might finally happen. And I'm like, okay, she's got to die, and now the plot's going to get going, and things are going to start to interconnect. But she walks into, I'm going to put my 90s nostalgia hat on. There's an episode of Goosebumps called The Ghost Next Door, where you find out that the one of the characters died in a fire, and they've been a ghost this whole time. I saw this plot reveal coming as soon as she took a left out of that street.
Really? See, I'm going to admit something I probably shouldn't admit on this podcast. This took me by complete surprise. I didn't see where this was going. Maybe I'm just naive, but I see this guy. This guy hasn't been in too much. I think he was in House of Dragons. I think that's his only fucking credit other than this one. I am thinking that he is going to be the love interest, and he's actually genuine. Now, there's a point where it hits me. It's when we actually see his parents later on, but this took me by surprise, boys. I didn't see where this was going.
This is when I think that you could have gone different direction, and this is why I like the way this is. One, I think it's legit. I have no idea that he's dead, spoiler, up until it's revealed. It is literally hidden. Maybe I should be embarrassed. Maybe I should know better. But there's so much. They never hide death from us in this. So maybe that the fact that they have one hidden is the trick, because there's no reason to ever hide it in these movies. But I think he's going to die, and Astrid is going to go to Beetlejuice to try to save him. Like, I think that's where it's going. And I like the misdirection. I think it's smart. I think this guy, Arthur Conti, hey, I love your dad's music. No, it's not.
Tom Conti from The Dark Knight Rises?
No, no relation to any of Hollywood's Contis. But
you know, you had me going. I thought he was.
I looked it up. I thought he was. I think he does a really swell job here as well with what he does. Like, I like the misdirection.
So let me say that just because I called this doesn't make it bad, because there is a actually clever piece of screenwriting, which is amazing given these guys wrote Smallville, which I never thought was clever. She is in denial that she has inherited her mother's abilities, and we find out that she actually has them. And there's a tell when she drops him off at the house, and she goes, oh, he's cute.
Yes.
That's a very clever tell, bit of foreshadowing, and you don't think anything of it. And this is also a return to the Edward Scissorhands outsider romance thing that Tim Burton used to be one of his strengths, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
This guy's had more humanity in his movies than Christopher Nolan has. And most of his movies are about dead people. A guy's scissors for hands. And this guy understands humanity more than some modern filmmakers do.
You know where I thought they were going with the Astrid father angle that they thankfully didn't go was... I hate that this went through my mind. I thought Beetlejuice might have been her fucking dad.
Oh, no.
And I swear to Christ, because they kept saying, well, you can see everybody, but you can't see my dad. Matt, I think working with you all these years has fucking gotten to my skull, because when they use the pronoun game and they saying my dad and him and this, I think it's going to be some kind of reveal. Of course, it's not. But like this piece of writing, I think what they do with that character, too, is very clever. I think there's a lot of clever writing going on here.
When it came down to her dad, I had no doubt in my mind he wasn't dead. Because they said they never found the body. He was just lost in the rainforest after plane crash. So, of course, the reason that she can't see him is because he's not dead. Like, duh. So the fact that it's just like, oh, no, never mind. I don't know. That ended up coming to me like picking apart 5 or 6 different script rewrites.
Well, I thought he was just going to show up in the third act.
Oh.
I thought she would call him, or Lydia would call or something. They would reveal, or maybe even the stepmom would reveal, oh, he didn't actually die.
That's what I was waiting for.
Living his life, where he faked his death and is the deadbeat dad that a lot of Tim Burton movies do. But we're introduced to Jeremy, who's the boy next door. They obviously have his connection, and he goes, your mom's Lydia Deet. To me, that was also a tell. Not in a bad way, but the fact that he's so into, like, weird music, and when he goes in the house and he says, my parents don't pay much attention to me, that put the thought in my head, okay, they killed him. Turns out it was actually the opposite. I knew he was going to be dead. I had no idea he was going to be a serial killer.
Yeah, that was a shock to me, too.
I like that twist, because when it comes up, I think, oh, they killed him. And then when it's the other way around, I'm like, yeah, there we go.
Yeah, or he died in a car accident or something, and that's why.
Yeah, because, you know, because he does reveal that he's dead. He says it in this conversation in the room, and we even see the marks on his neck. So we think that he's legit. We think he's telling the truth, but it turns out there's a little bit more to the story.
Much like Obi-Wan Kenobi, he's very good about selective information.
Yes.
Because it goes to see, she's like, all right, I'll see you later. And eventually she goes back over his house. Lydia's happy that Astra is actually forming a human connection because she can't do it through her daughter. So here's where I think the balls are. Burton's starting to drop a couple because he's cutting back to Beetlejuice. He's cutting back to Monica or Dolores sucking someone else's soul. You got stuff with planning for the wedding. There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
I do think it's unfocused, which I've said about a lot of Tim Burton's movies. That's, I think, his biggest weakness as a filmmaker still to this day. But eventually, Lydia decides to take Astrid to Jeremy's house for Halloween. So I also appreciate the movie actually takes place on Halloween and has fun with that concept.
Me too.
And she goes, wow, he's cute. And I'm like, yep, he's dead. That was the confirmation I needed. The hardest I laughed at this movie was him lip-syncing Richard Marx's Right Here Waiting.
Yes. I laughed hard at that too.
The ultimate 80s shitty power ballad.
2 weeks ago, you know what I listened to by Richard Marx? Hazard, which is about freaking death and killing by drowning.
Jesus
and
Christ.
This came up, and I could not believe it.
Holy shit. This is the only time I find Michael Keaton hitting on all cylinders as Beetlejuice. I love this scene with Lydia. Matt, you mentioned that the times he really hits is when he's interacting with the old characters. This is great. I love the reference to Kill Baby Kill as we see the baby. I love just the blood falling out and his organs falling. Like, all of this is fun stuff. I really enjoyed this scene with him and Lydia.
Yeah, and Rory doesn't believe in this shit, so him saying Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice doesn't.
Exactly.
I don't have that problem of why would you do that, which I've had of people doing dumb shit just for the sake of plot convenience, but this actually makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Beetlejuice is dressed as a shrink. Literally, much like the first one, staples her mouth shut.
Yes.
He gets a body horror with making her pregnant. Yeah, you mentioned Kill Baby Kill. I was thinking of It's Alive.
Oh,
the
yeah.
End of the movie.
Yeah, Leonard Cohen. There he
goes. Yeah, rest in peace. You know, Beale just literally spills his guts. We're getting a lot of fun stuff here. Like, this is very much in tune with him with the first movie. But you also have to take into account Michael Keaton is in his 70s. Can't exactly move around like he did back in the day. So I do think there's parts where his age shows, but I don't think he phoned it in, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
But he works best when he's with Lydia, because it actually feels like, oh, the movie's actually, it feels like the sequel I wanted.
Yeah, and I do think there's something when they're together playing off each other and everything else. I like Rory doing that whole, I'm going to give you the push, and he just says it real quick. Guess what? I hate him in the rest of the fucking scene, though. he's that thorn in my craw just sticking around. But having Michael Keaton and Winona together, like, they just, man, that's peanut butter and jelly. They're really jamming.
Yeah. Nice. Really jamming.
So she says, home, 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 and that's it. They get out. And she looks back, he's lip-syncing Richard Marx. I'm glad they used that for one of the TV spots, and I still laughed. I knew it was coming, and I still laughed.
I never saw it. I'm glad I did.
And that's what he used for the tickets are on sale now. Him sitting on the tombstone with the guitar made me laugh. So Astrid discovers that Jeremy not only sees a ghost, but she did inherit her mother's powers after all, so I guess supernatural foresight is hereditary. The X-Men. It's her mutant power to get passed down. So he asks her to come to the afterlife to help him regain his humanity. And he says, I'll let you see your father again. And I'm like, oh, that's the proof he's the villain. Because he dangled that carrot in front of her. And she took the fucking bait.
Playing by Sith rules, he never lies.
And I like how they bring back the thing of drawing the door. Well, also the tell is he's got the handbook for the recently deceased.
Yeah. They drop a line that, what, he got at a garage sale or something? Like, where did he?
He bought it at a yard sale.
Yard sale, yeah.
Which, if they sold the Maitland stuff other than what's in the attic, because you go by the Maitland's store, and it's now a coffee shop.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't find it far-fetched. I think that was a good way to explain it out. Mm-hmm. But it's obviously a misdirect. But I think it's smartly written.
Agreed.
Here's my question, though. I thought that handbook was something only the dead possessed.
No, because Otho picks it up in the first one.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. It just shows up, yeah.
Okay, that at least tracks. But when I saw the book, I'm like, oh, he's dead. I think there's a lot of things you can look up as they give plausible explanations, but also, like I said, I can kind of see the writing on the wall. Not just because he literally draws a door with chalk.
I do think they're keeping it surface. It's still a movie for families and kids that way.
And I like how it's revealed from a realtor of all people, which is the little connection. You know, same last name as Jane from the first movie.
It's the girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the girl grown up.
Yep.
You know, it's literally that small town thing of, I'm just going to do what my parents did and never leave.
Mm-hmm.
And she reveals, oh, yeah, that boy across the street. Yeah, he murdered his parents, and when the cops chased him down, he got hung from the treehouse. And, look, this movie's PG-13, but the dad's got an axe through his head.
Yeah.
And the mom's
got, like, an egg beater through her eye.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot more garish than I thought the movie would be on face value, because everything in the first movie, like, when they stretch their faces and stuff, it's kind of playful, and it's also hokey. This is that, like, Halloween Horror Nights type of prosthetic.
Yeah, this isn't Spy versus Spy, which is what I thought of with the heads and stuff last week. This is all, like you mentioned, garish stuff. This kid's a fucking serial killer. That's big time dark stuff. But again, I like that Burton's going here. And this is the beat of the film, the plot of the film that I like the most, which I would imagine if I was a teenager, I'd feel the same way. It doesn't hurt that Jenna Ortega is doing a marvelous job with this. I really enjoy what she's doing. She's not Wednesday here. She's playing it completely different. I would believe that this is the offspring of Lydia, because I could see Lydia getting in the same situations when she was 16.
So I don't like this, though, as a narrative device, though, because she's only here now to be rescued as the damsel for the third act. She does just become a plot MacGuffin.
Kind of, but it ties into how the father comes in, too. All of it is really gathering steam for the way it's going to conclude.
They go to the afterlife, and it's literally that same waiting room we saw from the first movie. Take a number. But it doesn't do that, like, hey, remember this type of shit that a lot of these types of films did. Like, there's not the cigarette guy sitting there still, or the witch doctor.
No, you there's different people. Like, there's a chick that, what's she have, cats or something on her? Like, there's some weird shit going on.
Oh, her cat's ate by her. Yes. She got in her apartment and got eaten by cats.
There's my worst nightmare.
Davey Vance's dream came true. I did think we were going to get a joke of, like, one person looking at, like, I've been here 30 years and have a super long number. I did think he had fun doing, hey, I get to play around, much like Guillermo del Toro likes to play with designs and stuff. I think Tim Burton loves going, hey, I get to draw up some cool stuff and practically put it in a movie. I don't know if these were as good. No, I'm going to say they're not necessarily as good as the first one, but it's fun to see this kind of practical work in this kind of film. It's always a delight going through this office.
In 2024, you don't see too many practicals like this. You know, it's mostly digital. And there's definitely digital work going on here, but I'm with you. I find a lot of joy here. And yeah, it's not as fun as last week, but it's still fun. I enjoy being here. I enjoy seeing the new images that Burton's putting on display here.
Absolutely. But you can tell this is where his heart is. It's not in the stuff that takes place above board, so to speak.
Oh, yeah. This, like Guillermo del Toro, he's more fascinated by the monsters than the humans, for sure.
Oh, yeah. And in how things look versus whether or not this narrative actually makes sense. But he feels that it's all a ruse, and she gets taken to the Soul Train.
Oh, which, I love this.
Oh, all right. Tim Burton has long been made fun of for not having black people in his movies.
Yep.
And he literally makes them stereotypical disco.
Matt,
you know, the
Matt, this I was a TV show. This was a 70s TV show. Soul Train was huge when I was a kid. I would turn on the TV.
But, like, read the room, Tim.
I would turn on the TV after cartoons, and I would sit there. I would dance with the people on the Soul Train. I thought it was very clever.
Adam, please have my back. Please.
I watched it Saturday mornings after the cartoons were over as well. I want to say it was like at 11 or 10.
Yeah.
Like once the cartoons were over, Soul Train started, and it was the whole, boop, boop, Soul Train. This is a funny joke for about 30 seconds. It's a very unfunny joke when it hits a 5-minute mark, and it's a stupid joke when you bring it back a second time in the same movie. There's a funny part here, but, oh, it just keeps going, and then keeps going. And maybe this needed to hit the runtime by having 3 full-length songs. I like it, but it also kind of just pigeonholed the Tim Burton puts black people in his movies because he only puts it in one scene, and it's a Soul Train.
It's a joke, guys. It's a fucking joke.
It's funny, but it goes on so long that it doesn't go back around to being funny. It stops. It's like, okay, move the scene along.
I thought that was Don Cornelius at first, but then I looked it up, and he's been dead for like 10 years.
It does look like him.
So when Lydia realizes that Astra has been taken to the other side, she summons Beetlejuice, and man, this guy just won't let it go. He says, all right, I'll help you out if you marry me this time. He learned his lesson, though, because he brings out a contract.
You talk about a joke that goes on too long. It's these fucking cops and, oh, God. I cannot wait to see Willem Dafoe in my most anticipated movie of the year, Nosferatu, but here you are doing no good, sir.
Yeah, not since The Boondock Saints have I seen him embarrass himself in a movie like this. Not just because he played a cop in that movie, too.
Mm-hmm.
Love that he's having fun.
Yeah.
But he's relishing it. I'm laughing. I'm smiling with him.
He's too good of an actor to be wasted like this.
That's everybody in Tim Burton.
You're not wrong.
No, you're not wrong. I mean, look, you can't say he's had a lack of acting talent. When you look at, like, Vincent Price, Christopher Lee, Ian McDermott, Michael Gambon.
Look at the cast of Mars Attacks.
Yeah.
But even, like, you know, his recent movies, I mean, Dumbo, we got Colin Farrell and Danny DeVito, Michael Keaton. This movie, he got Willem Dafoe and Justin Theroux on ironic rhyming. I mean, it helps he's married to Monica Bellucci now. So he can.
Yep. Is he married to her? I thought they were dating. Are they married now?
They're together. I don't know if they're married, but.
I was going to say, Jesus.
No, because I don't even think he married Helena Bonham Carter.
That's true.
I don't think he's married, yeah.
So Jackson starts a manhunt for Beetlejuice. They're kind of making their way through the afterlife. They get rid of Jeremy really quickly because this movie has like five villains.
Yeah.
But it's great use of your one use of the word fuck for a PG-13 movie where he's like, they're fucko, and he drops the floor out underneath them.
I agree, but I thought this was going to go on longer. I did not like the way he was dispatched, much like the first Islander that Indy sees in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom go into the fucking pit. I did not want to see him go into this version of hell without some kind of fight, some kind of stuff going on. This was a little disappointing to me.
I like that it was Beetle there behind the counter doing it, so it made me chuckle, it made me laugh. Much like when her dad shows up, he plays it straight. He's being eaten by piranhas. He's playing it straight the entire time, and I can't help but just chuckle that he's being a straight man while there's just piranhas feeding on his undead flesh.
I like the misdirection, too, because he does say, oh, I gotta go to the bathroom, and he's actually on his way to kill this kid, which is what he was told to do. So, again, I think that's more clever writing.
But, yeah, I do think there's a script where Jeremy plays a bigger role, and part of everything is like, yeah, no, we need to find a way to get him out, because it feels like a recut and reshoot.
And it's also, much like the first movie, Sandworm Ex Machina, when the father shows up in a sandworm.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, so I guess Beetlejuice sends Jeremy to hell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, part three.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's what we're going to see in part three.
Yeah, in 35 years from now when Michael Keaton's 100. And no, they're going to resurrect him like Peter Cushing in Rogue One.
Dude, this thing has made $200 million. I think we're going to see it within 3 years. Mark my words.
So they figure out, because they find their father, find a way to get back to the world of the living. This is where we get the dumbest scene in the movie where, of course, she says the snakes aren't venomous because she was told that. Catherine O'Hara gets killed.
Yeah, I didn't like this either. Adam's laughing. Jesus Christ.
This is what I thought, it was because she was so intent on doing it and this whole artsy type of thing. And then she pulls out the snakes and I'm like, oh, they're going to do it. And the way it plays, it's just a quick snip and she just collapses. Mm-hmm. And it's quick, it's fun, and it's fitting for the character. So, it made me chuckle. Though I was a little sad that they killed her off.
Yeah,
I didn't think that we'd be seeing Delia go.
I just feel like between this and Jeremy, Burton was using the word cut way too much.
There's a lot in here. There really, really is.
And it could also be, too, Catherine O'Hara probably said, yeah, I'll come back for one, but I'm not coming back for another, so they're going to kill her off. Although in Beetlejuice, like we saw with Jeffrey Jones, just because you're dead doesn't mean that, you know, you're not going to play a part in the film.
No, and this movie, they should have used the logic of a Halloween pumpkin and carved it up a little bit more before they started shooting. That's kind of my analogy.
She is his good luck charm. Catherine O'Hara, let's not forget, she's Sally. So I think if there's something else to be done, I do think she comes back. Though I could see a full afterlife movie in the third one.
So they get back to the afterlife, and this is where everything has to converge at the wedding.
Yep.
Everything from Dolores showing up to Willem Dafoe showing up and getting frozen. And I cringed because I was like, oh, good, we made it the whole movie without recreating them being forced to sing. And then they fucking do it because the studio told them to.
But it's to MacArthur Park, though. If the studio had made them do it, it would have probably been to Deo. This is to Donna Summer's MacArthur Park. And I will say this. I think this scene goes on too long. this scene could have been way cut, but Jeremy's scene was way cut, so we gotta elongate this final scene. Yeah, it goes on a little long, and it didn't seem like it was gonna have any real resolution to it. As opposed to last week when we talked about the end and the wedding scene there, there was a lot going on with that as well, but you could tell that there was some good writing going on there. I don't think this ends in a very satisfying way.
I have a problem with how we get there, because we've gone through everything else, went through the afterlife, we crawl up through the crypt, we're here, but Lydia's still going to go through with this wedding. Lydia is, she's a passenger in her own movie throughout this, and I think that's extremely problematic. She's still showing up for this fucking wedding for this douchebag. Why?
Yeah.
It makes no sense, especially after you just reconnected, and not in a loving way, which I think is smart, because 99% of every movie she's going to meet up with Astrid's dad, it's going to be a, oh, I truly loved you. It doesn't go there. I think that is such a brilliant piece of writing, because everybody does the love reunited. But there's no reason for her to show up to this wedding for Rory. None.
There's none.
I hate that part. But I love that if you're going to do this musical scene, he said, we're doing the full 7-minute fucking song.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I can't believe they went through every verse and kept it going until the second verse before I realized he was making everybody sing. And once he did, I'm loving it. I'm just having a ball with here at the end.
And they did put Winona Ryder back in the red dress that we saw in the first film. I like that touch as well. There are good things going on. But again, it just goes on a little too long.
I just hate how airtight that first movie is. And so much of this one feels like it's padded.
Yeah. As Adam mentioned, though, last week there was a reason for her to be doing this, because she was kind of stuck in that position. She's not stuck in this. She could very well.
She also did it. If you remember the first one, she did it to save the Dietzes.
Exactly. That's what I said.
Yeah. Here, she has no agency once again. And she proved her husband is still out there and still loves her, so she should have no impetus to continue going through with this.
Exactly.
Yeah, she's a hostage in her own movie. This is pretty close to character assassination, if you ask me.
I wouldn't go that far.
All right, but then I'll say the bullet grazed her. She pulled a Reagan and survived.
Her ear will grow back.
It's here because the first film ended this way, so we got to do it this way.
Everyone's at the church. Beetlejuice bursts in, and they give truth serum, so he's only doing it for the money. Beetlejuice tries to go on for the wedding with all the influencers. He sucks them into their phones.
This was genius. I enjoyed this.
That was Tim Burton having something to say.
Absolutely, yeah.
So the wedding's going on when Dolores bursts in. I'm sitting there going, oh yeah, that's right, she's in this movie. I totally forgot. And then the sandworm comes in, so we do just like the first one where they get, instead of Beetlejuice getting eaten, it's Dolores and Rory get devoured.
You notice that they call out that it's on Saturn, too. It's right by Saturn.
it's from Titan.
Yep.
And Willem Dafoe shows up, and I'm like, oh my god, just end this movie, please. And then he gets frozen, I'm like, oh god, that's how I feel like in this movie. I'm stuck and I can't leave.
You're really having that bad of a time at this point?
I'm not having a bad time. I just feel like the movie's over and it feels like it has to wrap up every single plot point because there's too many.
That's fair.
And I do like how, even in death, loopholes can be exploited, because we find out that by Beetlejuice bringing Lydia into the afterlife, the contract gets burned up and he gets sent back to the afterlife again.
You had an out. He was married to Dolores. You gave yourself an out. So you're out. You got both brides there at the altar at the same point.
The chick poisoned them. Give them a break.
So Delia goes back to the afterlife, and she finds his severed body, and she goes, look what happened to me.
Genius. I love Catherine O'Hara in this. Great line.
So they both get on the Soul Train because we're going to bring this funny joke back.
Yes. I'm all for it. Every time they show the Soul Train, I'm there.
That it's got different destinations. You know, you got Elysium Fields, you got Pearly Gates. Mm-hmm. Like, notice right there that I was like, that's sweet for something from Tim Burton.
But they with a lot of meanness of this movie, they should have had one for, like, Burning Cinder or Motel 666.
Shit.
So then we get an epilogue where Lydia decides to end her show because she wants to spend time with her daughter. And the movie ends on a Nightmare on Elm Street hallucination sequence.
Ah, but did you notice the music, Matt?
No, because a lot of Danny Elfman stuff blends together.
This isn't Danny Elfman. This is from Carrie. She has the dream and she's at the grave and Carrie's hand comes up and takes her, that's the exact music they use here. So I knew right away that there was something going on at the Circle K, and that's exactly what happens. And again, we have another reference to Kill Baby Kill, which we'll talk about. And of course, she wakes up next to him. Like, all of this, I thought this was very clever, actually.
We get our one little cameo, too. And it's blink if you miss it. But when Astrid gets married to, Dracula, Gina Davis is one of the guests.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Oh, wow.
Left-hand side, extreme left, that if you're not looking all the way to the left of the screen, you would never see her.
Ah.
No Baldwin, but Gina shows up.
Baldwin has a little bit of a PR problem right now.
And they won't let him cut the cake at the wedding because it's not a prop knife.
Jesus.
So we have, much like Children of the Corn Part 4, dream sequences on top of dream sequences because she wakes up and then Beetlejuice is in bed with her and then she wakes up again.
Yeah. I thought of just our recently recorded Children of the Corn 4, where all we talked about was how bad the dream sequences are. Coming soon, folks. Coming soon.
I guess the movie ends with Lydia realizing that this guy's never going to leave her alone, so she might as well put a ring on it.
Yeah. But how about this birthing scene, though? This was something that I wasn't expecting in a PG-13 movie either.
It's Nightmare 5.
Yeah, good point. But again, Mario Bava, too, right, Matt? I mean, this is Kill Bill Be Kill, too.
Oh, yeah. Carrie.
Mm-hmm.
Biggest something sweet I've ever seen in my life. That hospital room was gigantic. My insurance is crying over the size of that room.
So that's how the movie ends on Beetlejuice, or Beetlejuice 2. Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give this long-awaited sequel? Let's go to Garrett first.
Oh, wow. Me first, huh? Okay. Well, the three of us have kind of revolved this podcast around franchises. And when you get a franchise like this, movies that come out and then they collect dust, and then we have a new one with new sheen, you get what we call legacy sequels, which Matt and Adam and I have kind of railed against in certain instances. Go back to our Star Wars retrospective, Indiana Jones, all of those, and we'll be talking about more. So you label this a legacy sequel, and I'm going to come in arms folded. Go ahead. Please me. Now, this movie is, like I mentioned, it's longer than the 90 minutes of last week's film. And towards the end, especially during the MacArthur Park sequence, you start to feel it. But unlike my colleagues here, I didn't have too bad a time with the first 45 minutes of this. I enjoyed getting reacquainted with these characters that we saw all those years ago, especially Winona Ryder. And you know what? The movie moved along at a decent enough pace for me. There are some writing inconsistencies here. And that is a problem. I find some of the plotting to be just that, plotting, and that was to the point where I never crossed my arms, but let's just say I probably had my hand to my chin at those points. Not all the jokes hit, as comedies are well-to-do, but I think Winona Ryder, as much as she is not really utilized as far as a story arc, I think she loves being on the set, and you can tell that she's having a great time getting reacquainted with Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton was my biggest disappointment in this movie. I think there are instances where he's great. There are instances where he does remind me of that Beetlejuice character that we've seen before, but this character hasn't evolved, and I expect this performance to be, if not the same, then much, much similar to last week's film, and I find him to be very reserved in this. Willem Dafoe, you could have kicked him out, and I would not have had any problems with that. And I think Monica Bellucci, another new character, serves her entrance well, and I think her purpose in this movie is perfectly outlined when she's here, much to the chagrin of at least one of my other colleagues. And it comes to a conclusion that, as I mentioned, it kind of drags a bit. But you know what? We walked out of this movie with a huge smile on our faces. We talked about it the whole way home. We talked about it in bed before we went to sleep. And we'll probably talk about it tonight at dinner. I had a really good time with this movie. That being said, with all the inconsistencies with it, I'm going to give it the same exact score as last week's score. Because last week's movie, I had a very fun time with. But in the end, it came in to be a 7 because of a lot of plot holes being done in that movie. And I feel the same exact way here. There are plot inconsistencies. There are things that could have been tightened up, but I still had a hell of a time with this. This movie is getting a 7 out of 10.
Adam?
A lot of different ways that you can go around doing legacy sequels, and goodness knows, lately we seem to have run the gamut. I'm really glad that they brought back Tim Burton and the original cast to do this film. I think that was extremely important. I'm even glad that Danny Elfman came back, and I was surprised when I saw his name in the credits, because Elfman's got his own kind of weird stuff going on. I didn't think he'd come back. And he does a serviceable, being the operative word, because we barely talked about the score. And most of the rest of this film is that same way. It's serviceable. It feels like a script that has been written and rewritten and rewritten for the past 30 years, because it kind of has been. And that's a shame. At some point, you have to stop pay off the people who got a story credit, scrap it, and make something completely. Because there's so many added elements to this film, it makes it hard to fully enjoy like the first one. This movie is only 10 minutes longer than Beetlejuice. But it feels like it is Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. It feels twice as long. It's only 10 minutes longer, folks. The cast comes to play. However, I don't think they get to play until, as we've mentioned, or I've mentioned, about halfway through this film. The opening startup, get together, reunite, is done so poorly. I'm going to say poorly. It's a really poor job of setting up the film. But once it gets going, once you get to see Jenna Ortega's Astra take off on a bike down a hill, this movie also just kind of takes off full forward and is a different film, and it's very enjoyable at that point. I like the cast overall. Keaton looks older because, yeah, he's in his 70s, but yeah, he was Batman last year, the year after he was Beetlejuice, and now he's Beetlejuice again the year after he played Batman. So we're 89, 88 all over again. Catherine O'Hara is an absolute frickin' delight. As back as Delia. Winona is, she is so good, but I'm sadly disappointed with what they do to the character. She's like fourth now in the way of given stuff to do. She's behind Beetlejuice. She's behind Astrid. She's kind of behind Delia for a lot of this film, and she's certainly behind the abysmal Justin Theroux's Rory character. So for somebody who was the delight in the first one, I'm sad for Winona Ryder. Monica Bellucci is just a delightful character and a good presence. I wonder if we're going to see more of her in the next one. So get through the first 30, 35, 40 minutes of this film, and it turns on a dime, and it gets really fun. But, man, this thing is just chopped up worse than Dolores is before she gets put back together, and it shows, and it's a shame. Overall, it's a giant step down from the first one. Like, I feel like Jeremy falling into a hole from the first one to the second one, because that first one is near perfect, but this one is barely passable. I'm giving it a 6, and I think that's fair. I wonder where we're going to go next. I have some ideas. Maybe we'll discuss it after Matt, but yeah, this one's a 6 on 10. If you enjoy the first one, go see it. Just manage expectations.
So to your point, Adam, this movie has more additives than your Halloween candy that you'll be buying next month. And I think that's its biggest problem, is this really does feel like a project that went through the history it did, and they took all those ideas, because in all likelihood they didn't think they'd have another opportunity to revisit this world, so they went for broke. And I think this movie screams the importance of second draft, because a lot of this feels unrefined. But having said that, once the movie gets its ass in gear for the middle portion, I enjoyed myself immensely. I felt like I went back into this world like a nice warm bath, but it's preceded by a first act that I think is kind of sloppy and unfocused, and an ending that I think takes too long to get to the point, which we all saw coming. And centrally, my biggest disappointment was the Lydia character and my lack of endorsement for where they took this character. Obviously, the spinster instinct is gone, but a lot of what they do I've seen in other characters, with the estranged daughter and the manipulative boyfriend slash manager. I kind of wish they came up with something a little bit more unique, or something that really, say what you want about that first Beetlejuice movie, Garrett, you know, you didn't give it the highest score, but it's original, it's inventive, and I can't really say that for this movie, but it is a sequel, so you do have to keep that in mind. So that leaves me at a crossroads. Where do I score this? Obviously, to Adam's point, I don't like this movie anywhere near as much as I did the first one. But I'm also looking at it through the lens of this ilk of film, this trend. I like it better than a good portion of these. So I don't know if I'm ever going to watch this in its entirety again. But I appreciated a lot of the go-for-broke aspect with the design and some of the gags. I just wish the storytelling was a bit more robust. But I also know I'm not going to get that with Tim Burton. I've reached the fifth stage, boys, acceptance. So I'm going to land on the same score Adam gave. I'm going to give it a 6. If you're curious, go check it out. I think you'll have a good time. I did in the moment, but I don't know if this movie's going to have a lot of staying power. But it might have enough staying power combined with the box office revenue to warrant a third movie. Tim Burton jokingly said it took 35 years to do, so it'll be over 100. But I guess with science and advent technology, it's possible. I don't want a third one. but I will not be the least bit surprised if they make one.
Yeah, I don't think any of these people have signed Marvel contracts where they're obligated to do a third one or fourth or fifth. I'm with you, Matt. I say let it be. You go out on a high note, right? This thing has crossed the $200 million mark, which, God forbid, I mean, who would have fucking guessed that? You know, how many times have we seen these come out and they don't make anything? We saw it with Indiana Jones. Indiana Jones flopped. This one has already, it exceeded its first movie's box office take within its first weekend. That is incredible. So there's definite interest in it, but I don't think Michael Keaton is keen to coming back. I don't think Winona Ryder is keen to coming back. I definitely don't think Tim Burton's keen on coming back. I see this going down, but you know what? As soon as we say stuff like that, boys, one of us floats an article to the group that says they have agreed to a third sequel. So God forbid if we get it, but let's go out on a high note. Let's go out on this. Let's go out on Jenna Ortega and Lydia having their mother-daughter bond and just leave it at that.
Yeah, with this thing earning already over 200, it's going to be close to 3, probably top out around 3. I don't think there's any doubt there. Warner Brothers is at least going to open up the banks a little bit more. And I think maybe next time we see Beetlejuice come to Lydia asking for help. I think you got to turn it a little bit. But I don't know. I do find it hard to believe that everybody involved wants to come back. But I could see them having fun. I don't know. Maybe Dolores is out for revenge because I could use more Monica Bellucci. But I would say let sleeping dogs lie. But with this much money on the table, I mean, we said that with It, you know, when that was such a big hit. And they did a sequel, and now they're doing a series, and they're doing another series. So Warner Brothers is not one to leave money on the table.
Well, to be fair, it was not completed. It was
a one of two. Yeah.
As far as my take, you gotta remember, Warner Brothers is still digging themselves out of the hole that the DC franchise put them in. How much money did they lose on The Flash?
Yeah, no shit.
Yeah, that could be the thing that makes that decision final. You're right about that. I didn't even think about that.
This could be like it used to be for Burton, where they say, look, give us Beetlejuice 3 and then bring us whatever you want for your original idea. And that could be how this happens.
Having said that, they did have the highest grossing film of last year with Barbie. But I also don't know if that makes up 100% for the losses on The Flash.
Not when you lost Nolan.
And Wonka made a lot of money, so they've got some things that have... I think the success or failure of Superman next year will be the gauge on whether or not we get a sequel to this. That's my take. I think that's going to be their litmus test, and whether or not like they can go forward with that as their new franchise, or if they're going to dig this up again. It's not a definite, but this movie made a lot more money than I thought it would. So, remains to be seen. Thank you, boys, for joining me on this two-film retrospective.
This was a fun Halloween-themed retrospective. I'm glad that you convinced us to do this, Matt. This was fun.
Well, speaking of convincing, that leads to the other... You know, I feel like we said King 3 times, and that's how we, Adam and I, got sucked into this bullshit. Why don't you talk about our own circle of hell that you dropped Adam and I into?
Do I reveal that now, or do we wait till Alien Romulus is finished recording? Oh, hell, we'll talk about it now, and it'll show up on Alien Romulus as well if people haven't listened to this one. So, yeah, the good news for these guys and me is that we only have one story left in the Night Shift collection. The bad news is it is an 11-movie retrospective based on Children of the Corn, a 13-page short story. The way I have outlined this is we are not going to drag this out. These are going to be podcasts that are going to be released twice a week. And we're going to get 1 and 2 done after Alien, 3 and 4 done after the week after that. Like these are going to be probably 5-6 weeks. Maybe 1 week I'll even complete 3 in 1 week and we can release that. We're just going to get them done. But you know what? I'm going to go ahead and say we've already done a few of these reviews and there are some surprises there. There are things that I was not expecting these guys to like that they liked, and there were things I was expecting them to like that they didn't, obviously. And I think we're going to run the spectrum here. There are going to be moments of frustration, but yet I think once we complete it and we get to Kurt Wimmer's, the one who did Ultraviolet, by the way, his Children of the Corn remake that came out a couple years ago, I think it's going to be a satisfying retrospective, might be pushing it. But once we get done with that, there's a big one that we'll reveal towards the end of that retrospective. But yeah, our next portion of this site will be to finally go through Children of the Corn, and then we can actually probably get to some good King right after that, because there is great stuff coming up after that. But yeah, Children of the Corn is next.
So we got a lot of stuff coming up on the airwaves. Boys, thank you very much for joining me. Till next time when we talk about Prometheus, the living, the dead, Can they coexist on a podcast? That's what we're here to find out. Thank you, guys.
Astrid found this in the attic.
Ew. So?
So? Every now and then, I feel his presence, like he's lurking somewhere, just out of reach. But lately, I'm seeing him again. And I was really hoping this was all in my head, but now this.
Lydia, you need to take back your life. From the hanger-oners, from this thing. Where is the obnoxious little goth girl who tormented me all those years ago? It's time to find her.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Boy, do you know how to pick them. Let me ask you something. Is this relationship really solid? Do I have a shot at her at all?
Excuse me.
Sure. Am I overstepping my bounds? Just tell me. Come on.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Are you Juno, our caseworker?
Yes, I evaluate individual cases and determine if help is needed, deserved, and available.
Are you available?
No.
Check out the Percolated Media archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including The Incredibles movies, The Planet of the Apes franchise, Star Wars, Pirates of the Caribbean, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
What are your qualifications?
Ah, well, I attended Juilliard. I'm a graduate of the Harvard Business School. I travel quite extensively. I lived through the Black Plague, and I had a pretty good time during that. I've seen The Exorcist about 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every single time I see it!
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
We just want to get some people out of our house.
Ah, I understand. Well, look, in order to do that, I'm really going to have to get to know you guys. You know, we got to get closer. Move in with you for a while. Get to be real pals. You know what I'm saying? And
it truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
We're like peas in a pod, the three of us. Let's face it, you want somebody out of the house, I want to get somebody out of your house.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
You hate him, right? I hate him myself! Come on, kids, what do I have to do to strike a deal with you two, huh?
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
You bunch of losers! How dare you hear out the professional while he's working!
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Nice fucking model!
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
This is a safe space, okay? Feel free to express yourself. Don't be afraid. I sense there's an enabler here, but we'll get to that.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
God, you guys really are dead.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
Oh, I've got to go.
He has had one of the great surprising resurgences for the last decade plus. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. Birdman. God damn it. Birdman. Yeah, Birdman, and of course he was in Spotlight. I enjoy her in this, and Adam, if you enjoy her in this, you got to check out Wednesday.
I just think it's one that is a family, like we should, at least Laura and I, like, let's just sit and enjoy it. Yeah, yeah. Now, I'll say, because I like that type of dark Tim Burton, so I'm hoping it's with it. Like, I like Dark Shadows for that same reason, the Tim Burton version. Don't at me, people.
Oh, I God. Think,
God.
So
I think it's be awful.
I yeah. do like the snarkiness of it quite a bit. Maybe that's my Eva Green bias.
It is. So
I'm surprised it didn't show up in this.
For the record, Dark Shadows, though, has one really funny line about the, are you stoned? They tried stoning me once. It didn't work.
Chloe Grace Moretz is fun in that, but I remember not liking that movie at all.
And I'm like, really? Michelle Pfeiffer, this is the movie you come back to for?
Yeah.
So, Astrid, obviously. Adam was muttering to himself.
My favorite thing Otho used to do was hide right at the end of the episodes of He-Man, and you had to spot. Oh, wait, that was Orko. Never mind. Wrong.
We'll do the He-Man adventures in a couple of years.
Yes.
When they do the Avengers of Hasbro, where it's He-Man, Transformers, G.I. Joe. Uh-huh. Because you know that's coming.
Oh, of course.
Rory takes the opportunity. This guy just won't let it go. He says, all right, I'll help you out if you marry me this time. He learned his lesson, though, because he brings out a contract.
How do you think I proposed? Go ahead, Adam. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, Garrett got the same one for when he meets her in a con.
Yeah, and much like this movie, a cop will show up to start a manhunt.
You talk about a joke that goes on too long.
You had an out. He was married to Dolores. You gave yourself an out, so you're out. You got both brides there at the altar at the same point.
The chick poisoned them. Give them a break.
They were still married. Which one of us haven't been poisoned by our spouse, right?
Christ.
Oh, we're all going to be in counseling.
But yeah.
He's not home yet.
And speaking of robust, how about that Monica Bellucci, huh?
Robust.
No comment.
Thoreau. There you go.